For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So the title of my talk tonight is called Cultivating Faith. Reflecting on practice, many hours spent staring at the wall and bowing, fixing my robe or putting on my raksu, reflecting on these practices. The question comes up, what is gained or what is cultivated from this practice? And I think it's a question every Zen student asks, if not at the beginning, fairly soon after sitting down to take on formal practice. The first answer that Dogen tells us is, he kind of pulls the rug out and says, nothing. Nothing's to be gained. You are perfect right now. Anything that is happening in your life is exactly the way it's supposed to happen, exactly the way it always will happen, exactly the way it always has happened. In the first part of his... Dogen, by the way, is a monk that started the Soto tradition, which is the tradition that this temple or practices under. He was a monk in the 13th century, 1200s, right? In his Shobo Genzo, he points this out by saying, the way is essentially perfect and exists everywhere. There is no need to seek or to realize the way. The truth that carries us along is sovereign and does not require our efforts. Need I say that it excels this world? Who can believe that the expedient of mirror wiping is necessary? Essentially, the truth is very close to you. Is it then necessary to run around in search of it? So mirror wiping in Zen is a metaphor for practice. Can be said that dust collects on the mirror, and one way to think about Zazen might be wiping away that dust. But Dogen says that's not true. He says, who can believe that the expedient of mirror wiping is even necessary? Essentially, the truth is very close to you. Is it then necessary to run around in search of it? So that's one way to answer that question. But it leaves something out, I feel. And Dogen, once again, lets us... He doesn't stop there. He continues and says, even so, if there is the slightest error, there is a gulf as great as that between heaven and earth. If so much as a thought of agreeable or disagreeable arises, one becomes confused. For instance, you may feel proud in your comprehension, or you may feel prosperous in achieving Satori. Even if you acquire Satori in the blink of an eye, acquire the way and enlighten your mind, feel as if you could assault heaven itself and charge into the Dharma as if on a mere saunter, you may shortly lose the way of dropping off the body. So even if there is the slightest error, there is a gulf as great as that between heaven and earth. And this is where practice begins. So, again, reflecting on my practice, if I were to answer this question, I don't really need to because Dogen's already done it very well. But if I were to answer this question, what is gained or what is cultivated, I can say I've gained some very good friends, some very good teachers, a few gray hairs, kind of this piece of cloth that I hang around my neck. But all of those things, teachers come and go, retire, pass on. My teacher of a long time just recently retired, and it caused something of a stir. I used to sit at Zen Center of Denver and still do periodically go back there. It caused something of a stir to have this teacher who taught there for 25 years started the center in Denver. Isn't there anymore. And yet, he spent 25 years trying to tell us that nothing stays, nothing exists, nothing abides. So it's kind of ironic. So again, I haven't really gained or cultivated in the same way that I have gained friends and teachers. They will not stick around. So I don't feel like I can honestly say that I've gained them or that I've that practice has brought them about. So that's kind of discarding that notion. The one thing I can really say that has had kind of a stickiness in my practice is, and again, maybe this will pass too, but it's stuck around, was faith. Not something I expected. I thought maybe I would become sage-like or tranquil and peaceful all the time. And none of that has happened. I still get angry. I still cry. I still get frustrated. I still have harmful thoughts. But something I think that would not have come about without practice is this idea of faith. And so faith in what? When I was 11 or 12, my stepfather took me to, I was in sixth grade, took me to Promise Keepers. Have any of you ever heard of that? Has anyone ever been to Promise Keepers? Promise Keepers is, it's kind of a sweet idea, in the idea form. Promise Keepers is a group of Christians that come together, men, if you can get past the sexism of it. It's kind of a neat thing. They come together and agree in front of the Lord or whatever to be better fathers and brothers and sons. And that's kind of cool. That was kind of a cool thing. And it met in Mile High Stadium, which isn't the most intimate of spaces. But there was, I don't remember a lot about it. There was a lot of singing. I was pretty young. At some point, I think it was after lunch, we split into boys. I don't know how they delineated who was a boy and who was a man, but the boys went to a different location. Actually, it was McNichols Arena, which at the time was right next to Mile High Stadium. It's the basketball arena in Denver. And we had kind of the cool, like, fun, like, hip teenage version of Promise Keepers, while the men kind of did whatever they did. And at some point, I remember there was a man, and he asked us all if we had, if the Jesus Christ had spoken to us, if he'd spoken to our heart, you should come down and accept him as your Savior. He hadn't really spoken to my heart, but I think that there was a kind of just intense peer pressure, I guess, to come down. And so I came down, and from then on I was a Christian. And they encouraged a blind faith, which eventually faded on me, and I couldn't accept it. Again, I was really young, but after about 3 or 4 years, just didn't sit well with me, this idea of a blind faith. So then I had a period of just kind of wandering around, trying to figure stuff out. But that is not the faith that I think that I've cultivated through Zen. So through Zen, over long periods of time of kind of being aware of my surroundings and of my actions and of thoughts, both on the mat and off the mat, I've come to notice kind of some habitual ways of interacting with the world, and ways that kind of hinders me from this idea of that Dogen calls, you know, our essential Buddha nature, our essential perfect nature. And at the beginning of practice, it took a lot of faith in my teachers, in my in the process and the practice of trusting that these people around me said, and the process is doing something or not or whatever, that has kind of what's been cultivated over time. It's kind of hard to talk about. But at some point, there is, and it's not linear, so at some points I feel that I have a strong connection to this no-self or empty self, or but my faith is what kind of brought me to there, I guess. But then at other times, I don't feel very intimate with that, and my faith kind of carries me through those times as well. But I think the more I practice, I think the more anyone practices, the faith is reinforced through awareness of what is happening around you in your life. How are you living? What are you doing to cultivate that understanding of what practicing realization is? And so another Zen teacher who is the third ancestor from Bodhidharma. So Bodhidharma brought Buddhism over from India into China. And then supposedly there's this direct lineage straight from the Buddha, from Buddha to Bodhidharma, and then straight down through Dogen, down through Suzuki, and to Taigen. But he was the third ancestor after Bodhidharma. He, his only surviving teaching is called Affirming Faith in Mind. Now this is the chant booklet we use at Denver Zen Center. Somehow I acquired one. It was on my bookshelf. I don't know if I bought it, but it was there. So every session, right before, just to kind of put this into context, right before dinner, we read this very long recitation. It's about 5 pages. To give you some sort of context, and this is very similar to most session schedules, but you'll wake up at, maybe 4:45, sit for a little while until breakfast, then there's usually a work period and a break. Then you'll sit again for maybe 2-2.5 hours, always broken up by, at Zen Center we do 25-minute periods, broken up by 5-minute walking. Here we do 35, broken up by 10-minute walking, usually. So there's the morning sitting and then the breakfast, then the mid-morning sitting and lunch, and followed by a break. Then there's the afternoon block. Now, this may happen to some other people too, but I sit with a lot of pain in session. My body is not used to getting into this strange position. And after about the third or fourth day, it starts to become pretty painful for me. And this, especially when I first started sitting Sesshin, this afternoon block was just this behemoth that I did not want to go into, and was just very excited when it was over. At the end of this long block of sitting, there would be a exercise period, which is very needed and very enjoyable. And then we would recite this Affirming Faith in Mind, which I think if we have time, I might do the whole thing. Otherwise, I might just do... Are we okay now?
Yeah.
Okay.
We should stop at 8:40. So.
Oh, okay.
We have some okay. Discussion.
So I'd find myself at the end of these long, long blocks very raw. That's the only way I can say it. And very kind of primal. Like, I really just wanted to eat and I wanted to sleep, and that was about it. And everything that was happened was kind of on the forefront of my mind. But we would recite this, and after many, many, many times reciting it, it started to kind of sink in a little bit, to the point where I was giving this talk on faith, and then I realized, oh yeah, we used to chant about that. So I'd like to recite it for you, if it's okay. So I encourage you to maybe sit up straight, and Roshi used to say, listen with your toes. So this is Affirming Faith in Mind by Sang Tsong. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions pro and con. To founder and dislike and like is nothing but the mind's disease. And not to see the way's deep truth disturbs the mind's essential peace. The way is perfect like vast space, where there's no lack and no excess. Our choice to choose and to reject prevents our seeing the simple truth. Both striving for the outer world as well as for the inner void, condemn us to entangled lives. Just calmly see that all is one, and by themselves, false views will go. Attempts to stop activity will fill you with activity. Remaining in duality, you'll never know of unity. And not to know this unity, lets conflict lead you far astray. When you assert that things are real, you miss their true reality. But to assert that things are void also misses reality. The more you talk and think on this, the further from the truth you'll be. Cut off all useless thoughts and words, and there's nowhere you cannot go. Returning to the root itself, you'll find the meaning of all things. If you pursue appearances, you overlook the primal source. Awakening is to go beyond both emptiness as well as form. All changes in this empty world seem real because of ignorance. Do not go searching for the truth. Just let those fond opinions go. Abide not in duality. Refrain from all pursuit of it. If there's a trace of right and wrong, true mind is lost, confused, distraught. From one mind comes duality, but cling not even to this one. When this one mind rests undisturbed, then nothing in the world offends. And when no thing can give offense, then all obstructions cease to be. If all thought objects disappear, the thinking subject drops away. For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. These two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. In emptiness, these are not two, yet in each are contained all forms. Once coarse and fine are seen no more, then how can there be taking sides? The great way is without limit, beyond the easy and the hard. But those who hold to narrow views are fearful and irresolute. Their frantic haste just slows them down. If you're attached to anything, you surely will go far astray. Just let go now of clinging mind, and all things are just as they are. In essence, nothing goes or stays. See into the true self of things, and you're in step with the great way, thus walking freely, undisturbed. But live in bondage to your thoughts, and you will be confused and clear. This heavy burden weighs you down. Oh, why keep judging good and bad? If you would walk the highest way, do not reject the sense domain. For as it is whole and complete, the sense world is enlightenment. The wise do not strive after goals, but fools themselves in bondage put. The one way knows no differences, the foolish cling to this and that. To seek great mind with thinking mind is certainly a grave mistake. From small mind comes rest and unrest, but mind awakened transcends both. Delusion spawns dualities. These dreams are not but flowers of air. Why work so hard at grasping them? Both gain and loss and right and wrong, once and for all get rid of them. When you no longer are asleep, all dreams will vanish by themselves. If mind does not discriminate, all things are as they are, as one. To go to this mysterious source frees us from all entanglements. When all is seen with equal mind, to our self-nature we return. The single mind goes right beyond all reasons and comparisons. Stop movement, and there's no movement. Stop rest, and no rest comes instead. When rest and no rest cease to be, then even oneness disappears. This ultimate finality is beyond all laws, can't be described. With single mind, one with the way, all ego-centered strivings cease. Doubts and confusion disappear, and so true faith pervades our life. There is no thing that clings to us, and nothing that is left behind. All self-revealing, void and clear, without exerting power of mind. Thought cannot reach this state of truth. Here, feelings are of no avail. In this true world of emptiness, both self and other are no more. To enter this true empty world, immediately affirm not two. In this not two, all is the same, with nothing separate or outside. The wise in all times and places awaken to this primal truth. The way is beyond all space, all time. One instant is 10,000 years. Not only here, not only there. Truth's right before your eyes. Distinctions such as large and small have relevance for you no more. The largest is the smallest too. Here limitations have no place. What is not. What is not is. If this is not yet clear to you, you're still far from the inner truth. One thing is all. All things are one. Know this and all is whole and complete. When faith and mind are not separate, and not separate are mind and faith, this is beyond all words, all thought. But here there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. Yes. Probably don't need to say anything else. But the cadence of it for me is beautiful. I would often find myself at the end of a long sitting or in my life, I often find myself lost, confused, and distraught. But this last stanza, I think, for me, really stands out. When faith and mind are not separate, and not separate are mind. Now, this is mind with a big M, so Buddha mind. When faith and mind are not separate, and not separate are mind and faith, this is beyond all words, all thought. For here there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. He's basically just, Dogen later on basically distilled this into those first two paragraphs of the Shobo Genzo, talking about this interplay between the perfection of the universe and of us and connection to everything, but at the same time, we live in this world and experience all sorts of sensations and thoughts, and to me, what Buddhism has given me is the faith that is in me, that is in others, that is in everything, and helps me practice in my daily life. When I bow to the Buddha, or when I bow to Keizan, Taigen, I'm bowing to a wooden statue, I'm bowing to a skin bag, but I'm also bowing to this oneness, and it's been cultivated through whatever has happened. I'm interested in hearing what you have gained, or what you would like to gain, or what you would like to cultivate, or what you've cultivated, or any other questions that you may have for Taigen.
Or Josh. Thank you very much, Josh. That's lovely. So please, any questions, comments, responses for Josh? Feel free.
Josh, how would you say faith has informed your activity as a teacher?
In the same way it's informed my life. So, Jeremy and I are both teachers, in case you didn't catch that. We're teaching little Buddhas. We are Buddhas. Every action that they do towards us or towards each other is a Buddha action. And yet, we are their mentors and need to teach them how to live in this world and with compassion and knowledge. And how was it informing your teaching?
I think that shit happens and you come back and go at it again and keep faith that if you can bring your best effort, that it's happening. Whatever it is happening.
Is your best effort good enough?
It has to be. At that point,
thank goodness. Yeah.
I think it's funny because when I first started teaching, I realized how bad I was at it, and I was like, that's it. Like, that's what you got.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has to be good enough right now. So.
So I just recently read a book by Noah Levine called Dharma Punks. Yeah, it's really good. It's this memoir of his crazy life with drugs and punk rock, eventually leading to being a Dharma teacher. In his practice, he calls the practice of yes, which I really like. So, saying yes to everything. You could call this mirror, white beam, whatever you want, but saying yes to your feelings and your thoughts and your sensations, and even when the answer is no, saying yes to no. I really like that. So.
Just one point about this word faith. I think, and you described your early experience of being called on to have faith, our usual idea of faith is faith in something else out there. Well, maybe in a way this is similar. It's faith in practice, whatever that is. But, you know, the way you described it, and I really enjoyed that, and I really enjoyed the reading. In other words, an irrelevant trust or confidence, just in making your best effort, even if you know it's, even if you think, well, this is terrible, still, there you are. So saying yes to this kind of trust. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about those words, trust or confidence.
So I was thinking of the sixth paramita, patience, or
patience is the third, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay.
It doesn't matter.
Or Kanti,
Kshanti, yeah.
Kshanti. Sometimes I think it's translated as steadfastness,
mm-hmm.
Right? So I like that actually a little bit better than patience. But steadfastness is cultivated in practice, standing in front of life and as best you can. Ken.
You speak about mind and faith being the same. That implies a certain kind of self-acceptance in a way. You know, you're kind of accepting yourself as you are. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Acceptance. So that's the rub, right? When Dogen says there's no need to practice, you're perfect. The problem is you keep forgetting that. So practice is really just reminding yourself that, and not just you, but everybody, everything, every. So I think that trust, and that's really hard to do. Especially if you have, you know, self-confidence issues or, you know, whatever. That's really hard to say, yeah, everything that's happening right now in this crazy mess up here is exactly what should be happening. That's really hard, I would say. Yeah.
there ever any discussion around the Denver Zen Center that the reading before dinner was too long?
In my mind? I think Roshi did it on purpose. I really do. He's kind of a stubborn jerk at times. But no, I really do. I think he had that kind of Zen warrior aspect to him, and he grew up with Kapler Roshi. He also studied with Apin Roshi. Kapler Roshi was a very, very stringent teacher. And he thought, and he never took it to extremes, but he really did think that there was something to be learned from some discomfort. Mm. And I wouldn't put it past him.
Probably need time for the kitchen to get ready.
It was also that, too, but yeah.
And did you say it was Bodhidharma that wrote that?
No, the third ancestor, Sengson. The third ancestor coming from Bodhidharma. Yeah. So 500 AD is when he was.
That would be hard, because I know I'm hungry right now, and I was just like trying to picture like sitting here like waiting for the kitchen, and I'd be like, man, that's really. But then having faith that you have food now.
Yeah. Well, you do have faith. I have faith in Sangha, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I really liked your talk. And I wonder, because you said something, I feel like I'm getting messed up in my head, but like if somebody were to learn and have the experience, like say here first, not having any experience with any place, any kind of faith, and the... So having that and coming in, practicing for a while, maybe kind of developing some faith or having that moment, mm-hmm. and then leaving, deciding, I'm not feeling this, and then going. I mean, it could be the opposite way as well, right? Yeah. I mean, and then go to maybe a Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, it could go both ways. But it definitely went this way. For me as well, and I really felt it as soon, you know, pretty quickly for me, which I'm grateful for. But you know, that just this faith of kind of for myself at first, but knowing that this was it. Like that, I mean, I don't know. It was just pretty, pretty intense, and so, and I still have that, you know, and. And I can't describe it, but so I just want to say thanks for talking about it and trying to put it in words, and you did a good job, so thank you.